Thanks for listening to the best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
You know what's easy? Hindsight when it comes to the decision that the Philadelphia Eagles made with Carson Wentz contract. I am looking right now. They put up on the broadcast last night during Monday Night Football that the Eagles had given Carson Wentz $109.9 million guaranteed money. Okay. If you look at the dollars that they are owing him as the Eagles, the cap hit that he has got in the years ahead, this year, you might be like, okay, what are the Eagles playing from a cap perspective on Carson Wentz? $18.6 million. That's how much the cap hit is for Carson Wentz. Okay, that doesn't sound brutal. Here's where it gets bad. $34.6 million next year. $31.2 million in 2022. $36.2 million in 2023, and really a lot of that money is guaranteed dead cap money. And I just look at it and I say, this is a cautionary tale about what you have to do and be careful of when it comes to locking up your quarterback. Because for a while there, it seemed like Carson Wentz was going to become the next great quarterback in the NFL. And then it just didn't happen. And this actually happens more often than you think when you look at NFL MVPs in recent years. There are sometimes guys who win the MVP and don't end up being as dominant as you would expect for someone to be, right? And look, I think it might end up happening with Lamar Jackson. I think it's possible that Lamar Jackson won the MVP, and he may be an okay quarterback, but there's no way that he's ever going to be a transcendent quarterback, and this happens every now and then. Matt Ryan won the MVP. Matt Ryan's a pretty good quarterback. He may even be a Hall of Fame quarterback. I'm not sure that Atlanta Falcon fans are sitting around like, I can't even stomach the idea of Matt Ryan no longer being the quarterback, right? Cam Newton won the MVP. He had a remarkable year, but it was just one year. And so you look at sometimes the guys who win the MVP award, and every now and then somebody sneaks in and you're like, okay, this guy just had the career year of his life. And as a result, he's not necessarily going to be dominant for years and years to come. Like Tom Brady won three, Peyton Manning won five, Aaron Rodgers has won two. Guys who win multiple MVPs, usually pretty good players. There's a lot of single winners in the NFL that aren't necessarily great. Again, Cam Newton, Matt Ryan, remains to be seen how good Lamar Jackson is. And Carson Wentz is kind of in that camp, where if he hadn't gotten his knee injury the year that the Eagles went on and won the Super Bowl, Carson Wentz was going to be the MVP that year. And that's what the Eagles thought they were getting. And I'll be honest with you, when I watch Carson Wentz play, I question whether he sees the field at all in a way that he's progressing in his knowledge as a football player. NFL defenses will catch up with you, but every year since then, it feels like Carson Wentz has gotten worse. And this year, admittedly, they have an incredibly injured offensive line. He's getting decked. He has no time behind the line. That could impact all of his decision-making. But did anybody watch last night's game and think, oh, man, are they lucky that they have got Carson Wentz locked up? Or if you're an Eagle fan, did you sit around and say, my God, what in the world were we thinking when we committed $110 million to this guy? And you know that sooner or later he's going to turn the ball over. I mean, it's just going to happen. And I think it's because he's trying to do too much. But you're talking about playing in such an awful division. I really thought the Eagles were going to come out tonight and find a way to keep it close and maybe steal a win, because the one storyline of the NFC East that you can rely on at all is every time you think the NFC East team is eliminated, they find a way to win a game and make you think they still have a chance. It's like The Godfather. Just when you think you're out, they pull you back in. We had this conversation on television for Cousin Sal's Dallas Cowboy fan. It's like they go and they beat the Minnesota Vikings to make you think as a Cowboy fan, hey, maybe we can continue. Maybe we can beat the Washington football team. And then we'll be in first place and we'll be right back in the mix. And I guarantee you there are a lot of Eagle fans that were coming into Monday Night Football and they were like, we haven't been that good. But the Eagles, they'll find a way to be competitive against the Seahawks. And as a result, those numbers that I just ran through, when it comes to all the money that Carson Wentz is owed now, it hamstrings the Eagles in a really big way. And it's really a larger context to NFC East issue. And by the way, trust me, we'll break down the Seahawks angle on Monday Night Football and what we learned from their win. Primarily, it's how good the defense has suddenly become. Carlos Dunlap finally starting to make some plays. They've really, once they got one rush defensive end, it was like everybody else suddenly started to play a lot better, because you get a little bit of pressure on the quarterback and suddenly the rest of the defense has much less issues associated with it. But to me, this is a big issue for the entire NFC East. What do the Cowboys do at quarterback? I don't know. I kind of think they should let Dak go, and now that they're drafting third or fourth, go out and actually get a new quarterback in the first round and try to follow the roadmap that was set by all the other teams, the Eagles with Carson Wentz, the Rams with Jared Goff, the Seahawks with Russell Wilson, and the Kansas City Chiefs with Patrick Mahomes, and be able to have success with a young quarterback. I kind of think it makes a lot of sense, honestly. And I don't know that the future makes sense with Carson Wentz, but I don't think there's any other play that the Eagles have right now. And I think if you look around everybody else, Alex Smith, maybe the Redskins, the Washington football team, feel like they can roll with him. Daniel Jones, I know he's got the injury issue right now, but he's going to be back. Maybe he gets his team into the playoffs in the worst division in football. I don't know what the Cowboys do, but I can make you an argument that the Eagles are in the worst spot of anybody in the NFC East, because unlike those other teams, they have no real options. They're stuck with Wentz. When we come back, I got my buddy Chad Withrow from 104.5 The Zone in to talk about some of this Vandy kicker controversy.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Joined now by my buddy Chad Withrow. I started doing radio with him, like 12 or 13 years ago now, Withrow?
It's been 2007, Clay. I think actually met in 2007, started the radio show in 2008. So, yeah, we're getting old, and we started this a long time ago together.
Yeah, and we started, and I might have told this story on the show before, at Withrow Zone. You can follow Chad Withrow at 104.5 The Zone there as we roll through the Tuesday edition of the program here. We started a show on Tuesday nights, and we met back when Tennessee was actually the last time Tennessee was in an SEC championship game, which probably neither one of us would have believed it would ever be so long again, and who knows when it's actually going to occur again. But it was 2007 when Tennessee was playing against LSU, and that was the year that LSU basically thought they were totally eliminated from being able to contend for the championship. I feel like that was the West Virginia – sorry, West Virginia fans out there listening right now. Was that the West Virginia loses to Dave Wannstedt and Pitt game? And suddenly LSU got into the championship game and won it as a two-loss team. And remember that year LSU with Les Miles won the national championship. They lost two games in overtime. And they came back and won a game late against Tennessee. I think Tennessee was up like 14-7, threw a pick six, or maybe it was tied and they threw a pick six, whatever it was. It was a hard-fought win for LSU, and then they go on and win the national championship.
Yeah, Eric Ames threw a pick six to LSU. West Virginia lost to Pittsburgh. I want to say there was one other game that Saturday that swung.
Maybe
LSU's
UCLA
favor.
Beat USC or something like that. One of those kind of games.
It was something else crazy that happened for USC to get in that national championship game against Oklahoma that year, I believe it was, and then won the national championship with Les Miles. But crazy circumstances to get to that. And Clay, you just gave me an idea. Maybe we're the ones who cursed Tennessee football. Well, ever since we met the night before the SEC championship game, Tennessee hasn't been close to getting back. So maybe it's us. Maybe we're the problem.
Yeah, certainly there's some people who definitely believe I'm the problem. And speaking of problems, so there's a bunch of different stories I want to get into with you. But I want to start with this this controversy surrounding Vanderbilt and the female kicker they brought out for the second half kickoff and everything that's gone on since then. And Derek Mason gets fired and all the other associated storylines. I spent a decent amount of time on yesterday's show and, you know, kind of unpacking this and why it didn't make sense to me. And the thing that I focused on, and you're an NFL fan too, so you'll understand this analysis. In the NFL, they don't have big rosters, right? You look on the sideline, college football teams can have 20, 30, 40 guys who are never going to play that are on the sideline for games dressed out. And so it's usual that there's a kicker and there's a backup kicker. There's probably a punter and there's a backup punter. All those things are normal. In the NFL, it's fairly common that, let's say, your kicker strains a quad and isn't able to continue, and the punter might have to do it. You know, it's probably every season or every season this happens a couple of times, right? The punter hurts himself and somebody else has to come in and punt, usually the kicker or whatnot. So when I saw this whole Vanderbilt needs a kicker story start to emerge, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. And then, like a lot of people, I watched on Saturday because I was like, well, I want to see, is she going to actually attempt field goals? Is she going to attempt extra points? It's an intriguing story for this Vanderbilt-Missouri game. And as I'm watching, they keep trotting out the punter, who actually was probably Vanderbilt's best player on the field on Saturday, and he punted seven times, Withrow, for an average of 43 yards. And so as I'm watching, I'm thinking, wait a minute, it's a lot tougher to punt than it is to kick off in a game, right? Like, if you told anybody out there listening right now, hey, you have two options. You can get a running start and go kick a ball on the field, or you can get the ball snapped to you, have to catch it, have everybody rushing at you to try to block a kick. You have to get the kick off, and then you have to be the last line of defense in the event that the punt returner is trying to return it. It's a lot harder to punt in an NFL or a college game or a high school game for that matter than it is to be an actual kicker, right? Like just running up and kicking the ball off. So this story that Vanderbilt didn't have a kicker doesn't make sense to me because the punter could have clearly run up and popped the ball up in the air and kicked the ball a lot further than she did, right? Like this is not rocket science.
Well, and Clay, I know that you see this a lot. It seems that common sense goes out the window in how people react to stories. And there are so many media members nationally and locally here in Nashville, where I'm located in the media, that wanted so badly for this to be this sort of Arthur Ashe Courage Award moment with Sarah Fuller, that they're not asking the obvious questions. I have nothing against Sarah Fuller. I think it's a cool story that she went out there and she became the first Power 5 woman to play in a Power 5 game for a Power 5 school. I think that part of it's cool. I don't think it's great, and I don't think the story is great, and I think you're hitting on a few things. Harrison Smith, who's the punter at Vanderbilt, averaged 43 yards per punt, had a long of 53. Now, I've done some digging on this because I'm interested in it. He is not a good kicker. I talked to someone that was associated with him at Brentwood Academy, south of Nashville, where he played. Not a good kicker. He can drop kick. So he can actually punt the ball off the ground and does it pretty well. Now, I asked this person, could he go out there and squib kick it to the 37 the way Sarah Fuller did? And they said, absolutely. They could have asked him to do that. And he probably could have gone out and attempted extra points as well. Vanderbilt also has a reserve defensive back. And the SEC Network broadcast team mentioned this. But they have a reserve defensive back that's a sophomore that kicked all through high school.
Yep.
For his high school team. That was available also. You could also go for two. So this whole narrative that they had to bring her on, right, that they were forced to do it, they had to do it, this was the only option. I know for a fact that the former NBA kicker, a prestigious private school in Nashville, who was a good kicker, reached out to the Vanderbilt coaches. He's a student at Vanderbilt and
yeah.
was offering up his services to go kick. And they basically shut down. There was no competition. There was no real tryout. They shut it down, and then Sarah Fuller was tweeting out, you know, pictures of her in uniform, and Vanderbilt was hyping it up also. So, look, I think two things can be true. It's a cool story that she had an opportunity to do this. It's cool to see her go out there and kick in a game. And it's also clearly a publicity stunt. But by whoever it was that decided this was going to be a thing, I'm not sure who. I just don't buy that this was your only option. If you want to argue what the way Vanderbilt coaches were today, that, well, she gave us the best option to win. I don't necessarily buy that. I also think that it's quite the extreme when you think of other options they could have had to go out and kick in this game.
Yeah, and look, to me it becomes even more apparent to be like, and look, I'm not opposed to positive stories, right? But don't sell me something that is artificial and claim that it's authentic, right? Like, everybody out there has gone into Times Square or place like it.
I'm not opposed to positive stories, by the way, Clay. Should be on your tombstone. Yeah. I'm not opposed to positive stories.
Yeah, like, you know, like, some people are like, well, why do you even ask questions like this? Because I care about authenticity, right? If you're selling me on this was the best chance we had to win a football game, I'm not buying that, right? And also, this ties into it even more. She addressed the team at halftime. I don't know how many locker rooms you've been in your life with her. I know you've been in a bunch. And I have, and I bet almost everybody out there, regardless of where you have played, whether it's soccer, whether it's football, whether it's you know, basketball, whatever sport you might have been in when you've been in a locker room, if somebody who isn't on the team and has never actually stepped foot on the field with you, blood, sweat, and tears throughout the season, suddenly gives you a lecture at halftime about how you're not cheering enough on the sideline and how you aren't excited enough when first downs are happening, I'm sorry, I'm tuning it out. And if that person is a flipping kicker, I would love out there for right now, if you have ever had a kicker, if you're a football player, any level, high school, college, pro, I bet there isn't a single kicker out there who has said, hey, I need to address the team at halftime. And if they did, it better have been like Adam Vinatieri, a Hall of Fame greatest kicker who has ever lived, right? Kind of generational talent. And even then, I think a lot of guys would roll their eyes. This girl addressed the team and ripped them, and she had never actually played in a game yet when she did it. She hadn't played a snap. And the way that Vanderbilt played, they played their worst game all season. And to me, it was like the team was rolling its eyes and saying, we feel like the fix is in.
Well, and can you imagine, and not even sports. All right, take the sports thing aside for a second. Imagine if Barry in accounting came into a department head meeting and he had just been with a company for 4 days.
That's a great point.
And these department heads had been with this company for years, multiple years. They had seen the ups. They had seen the downs. They had been there for 12 hours a day. They're trying to pull this company from the depths of despair. They're trying to turn it around for this company. And Barry, who comes over from Cracker Barrel, where he was an accountant, and Cracker Barrel was doing well, but not quite at the level of this new company he works with, decided that, hey, this is my moment. I'm going to take my chance. This is my one shot. I'm going to address this management team and tell them how to get things done. I mean, I give Sarah Fuller credit in that the confidence it takes to ask to address the team and tell them, hey, this is how it's done on a championship team. I just won the SEC championship with my women's soccer team, and we have enthusiasm for each other. And we're getting a first down on the sideline. I'm the only one over there cheering. And the fact that the coaches and players allowed it, and Clay, not only that, a Vanderbilt coach told a reporter, or I'm sorry, Sarah Fuller told a reporter that a coach came up to her the second half and said, you know, Sarah, what you said at halftime, I've been wanting to say that all year. Thank you so much for saying that. This is a coach. This is a paid coach for Vanderbilt saying that the girl who came over from the soccer team to have one kickoff, that her halftime pep talk was something he wanted to say all year, and he didn't. That is the biggest embarrassment of the program.
The whole thing is ridiculous. How about the fact that you talk to the media and tell them what you said? Like, the sanctity of the locker room typically extends to, yeah, what's said in the locker room, we don't really go to the media and tell them what was said. I think this thing was recorded. I think it was set up. I think we're going to see a ridiculous ESPN 30 for 30 hagiography on this. And the fact, like, they're going to reenact the kick, and it's going to turn into one that, like, went into the first row in the back of the end zone when they make the Disney special about it, instead of like a little, you know, dink kick. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But you like the analogy that you gave is a great one. The analogy that I would make is like, this is as if, you know, we have people sitting in on the show sometimes who are not on the show. And it would be like if instead of going to Danny G or Dub or Roberto or Eddie, all the people who regularly work on this show, if we had a random dude who was on the show and he just started talking over me, right? Like, this is my show and he's never been on the show. Nobody knows who he is. And we're talking about Monday Night Football and he just steps in and he's like, hey, I'm going to take, I got like 10 minutes. I want to talk about the game if I could. And I'd be like, excuse me? Like, this is my – and then he was like, here's what I think that you do wrong on your show, right? And then, like, everybody's just out there kind of, like, looking around like, wait a minute. Is this Outkick with Clay Travis or is this some random dude who's literally never been on the show before and then he's just going to start talking for 10 minutes and expect me to listen and that I've learned something from him despite the fact that for years I have been doing radio on this show and he's never done it. And he just comes in and he's like, you know, at my local show in, you know, and we may have an affiliate there, so I apologize, nothing against it. But in my local show in Peoria, Illinois, this is what we did. And this is how we ended up winning the prestigious Peoria Marconi Award. All right. I mean, congratulations. But I kind of think that that's kind of the equivalent of girls soccer versus major college athletics, or really, frankly, anything other than football and maybe basketball. There's no real comparison, right? If a diver gets up and they're like, hey, this is how we do the diving stories, or if somebody out there is like, hey, this is how we handle track and this is how the team works together on track, I'm not that interested in how your team does. It's just, it's crazy to me. All right, now,
well, there's so many different layers to this, Clay, and think of it this way also, because I'm sure the people on Twitter are going to call you a caveman and a sexist and everything else for everything that you're saying, and they're probably going to say the same about me. I'm a father of two daughters,
yeah.
Okay? And we're getting a lot of this from, you know, sports media members of, now I can look at my daughter and tell her that you can do anything in life. You can do anything. And I'm thinking to myself, what an insult it is for those dads that what they're saying about women's sports is that it's not all that important if you were then saying, the moment that I could tell my daughter she could do anything was when Sarah Fuller had a second-half kickoff in a 41-0 football game. A young woman who just won an SEC title at Vanderbilt. We just had a woman appointed to the Supreme Court. That's a moment where you look at your daughter and say, hey, you can,
you
do,
can
anything.
Do anything.
There's been,
yeah,
multiple women that have been appointed to the Supreme Court. Look at all the different things. The 99 U.S. Women's National Soccer Team captivated an entire country. That's a moment where you can say, hey, little girl, you can do anything. The whole thing is just very odd to me. And again, it's nothing against Sarah Fuller. She's really done nothing wrong in this.
Well, except for suggesting, like, that to me, it's really weird that she thought she needed to address the team. Like, that's, to me, way outside the bounds.
And that may go.
And that's more of an indictment. That's more of an indictment. Yeah, right. That's more of an indictment of the coaching staff than it is her. Like, Derek Mason's like, yeah, I do think you should talk to the whole team and tell them they stink and they don't cheer enough on the sideline. Really? Like, that to me is crazy. And by the way, here's the official release. They named her co-special teams player of the week. And I'm glad you made that analogy. Like, I've got three sons, so I tell them they can do whatever they want, as any parent should. But I don't want to tell one of my kids that they should aspire to do something and be rewarded for it only because of their identity, right? And not because of their overall talent. And here is what I'm talking about. In this release that they sent out from Vanderbilt University, she took the opening kickoff of the second half against the Tigers as her, this is a direct quote from Vanderbilt University, as her perfectly executed kick sailed 30 yards and was downed at the Missouri 35-yard line. That entire paragraph is written by Vanderbilt University, and it's so absurdly ridiculous that I want to read it again, all right? And I'm a double Vanderbilt alum. So I went to grad school and got two different graduate degrees at Vanderbilt. I love the university. I want to make that clear. But whoever wrote this section here, She took the opening kickoff of the second half against the Tigers as her perfectly executed kick sailed 30 yards and was downed at the Missouri 35-yard line. If you kick the ball out of bounds on an opening kick, you get the ball, the other team does, at the 40, and every coach slams down his headset and curses the kicking staff to the moon, right? Like, they're all furious. The intentional plan here was to give a team that you were already losing to by 21 points the ball 5 yards worse than the absolute worst-case scenario kick. And that is a kick that sailed, and that's a kick that deserves credit, and that's a kick where somebody gets named the co-special teams player of the week. I mean, this is crazy. I feel like I'm living in an upside-down world.
Do we want equality, or do we want to reward someone because of their identity and because
that's the question.
They're the first? And that's where the play. That's where I think this is a cool story, and it could have been a great story. The great story is the girl who kicks for her small local high school throughout high school, is a decent kicker, walks on to a major program, and because of COVID quarantines or whatever, gets a shot and goes in and kicks and does well. I just don't get the same Disney sense of feel good story for a girl who joined the team midway through the week at the end of a losing season where Vanderbilt's probably not going to win a game, who just won a soccer championship for the school and goes and hits a, I'm trying to get with the wording of the press release,
a perfectly
executed ball that sailed to the 37-yard line, bounced, and was down to the 35-yard line. I think anyone with any common sense, take any bias out of it, anything else, if you have any common sense, it's okay to acknowledge some of these inconsistencies. There was a local host in Nashville who compared it to Jackie Robinson in breaking into Major League Baseball. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, the insanity of some of this drives me crazy. I know it does you as well.
All right, can you come back for one more segment with us? Because I want to unpack this a little bit. Comparing it to Jackie Robinson is, I wish I had the audio of that, because it's truly one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
We are joined now by Billy Lucci, who is the owner of TexAgs.com, a wildly popular site that covers the Texas A&M Aggies. Billy, thanks for getting up early with us, first of all. And second, a lot of years I know you've covered Texas A&M. And in recent history, A&M has been in a position where we talk about them in September and October, and then they kind of have that swoon later in the season. Three games left to play, coming down the stretch run, Auburn this weekend, then you got Ole Miss, then you got Tennessee. Why is this team different? Do you think they are? Where can they go? It's a lot of questions all rolled into one.
Yeah, and you're so right, Clay. I mean, I know your interest in A&M spiked, and when we first started to get to know each other was during the conference realignment. And then, so you've been a close follower of A&M football since at least then. And right at the beginning of that, even with Johnny Manziel, don't forget that that team lost, I think they were 2-2 to open conference play. So they didn't even have this opportunity.
Yep.
So it's been a while, but I'll tell you what the difference is, Clay. And I'm writing, you know, I know everybody was down on A&M's offense this week, and it's funny because they ignore 12-7 against Louisville for Notre Dame. They hype up a 14-point win over North Carolina, and then A&M gets panned and, you know, drug over the coals for a 13-point win over LSU. This team in its last four games has gotten better and better, and they took a step back offensively. I think 3 weeks off and all the insanity of the contact tracing, which led to about 15 guys not being able to practice for 2 weeks, and I think it showed up. But if you look, here's what's different. What's different is Jimbo Fisher's teams historically have played their best football in November. And you saw A&M do that in year one under him. And I think second, Clay, they're not incredible at anything. When you watch them, you don't go, gosh, that's the best team in the country. But if you go back and look, they run the heck out of the football. They've got arguably one of the two best backs in the SEC, and Isaiah Spiller. They've got a future high-round draft pick at tight end. They've got four senior starters on the O-line, and the fifth guy's a sophomore that'll probably be a first-round pick. They block. They've given up three sacks this year in seven games. They run the football. They've got a senior quarterback that up until Saturday was playing the best ball of his career. And then defensively, quietly, they rank second, and they rank second in the SEC against the run, and they lead the conference in total defense. So this is a very well-balanced, well-rounded, up until they're fifth in the country in third down conversions, led the country heading into Saturday when they were miserable 2-16. So, Clay, here's the thing. They check every single box where they're, like, good at everything and really good at a lot of things. And there's very few what I would call weak spots in this football team. And the schedule that looks so daunting at the beginning of the year, they got by Alabama and Florida at 1-1. And then you really look at the rest of that schedule, and LSU is down, and Tennessee's down, and Auburn's just all right, and Mississippi State was bad, and Arkansas's better, but they're still probably going to finish 3-7. So a 10-game SEC schedule that wasn't nearly as daunting as it looked when they put it together.
We're talking to Billy Lucci. He's the owner of TexAgs.com. So I'm really kind of fascinated by the fact of the couple of games getting canceled, because we've talked a lot on this show, and I know you and I have texted back and forth about this. A&M had very few positive tests. It was all almost entirely contact tracing. Now that you're through that, what can you tell me about what occurred at A&M that led to two games being postponed? And how fortunate is A&M that they're in the SEC where you can get games postponed as opposed to canceled? Because if A&M has the same issue in the Big Ten or the Pac-12, those are games that never get made up.
Yeah, and could prove very costly, because you look at this playoff chase, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But, I mean, losing a couple games there would have been devastating, especially winnable games, you know. And so they had – okay, so here's what they had, Clay. They had one player test positive after Halloween, and they played Arkansas Halloween, and then that following week leading up to South Carolina, they had a starting safety not make the trip. He was positive. Okay, so he's out for the next 10 days. So two games. And coming back, they get back on Sunday, and they test on Sunday. And one player and one staffer, let's just call it a GA. I don't know his exact position. Not one of the main coaches, but one staffer and one player had it. Well, the player, you all of a sudden, so let's say he's a DB, a defensive back, which he was. So he had a defensive back. And you go team meal, they're sitting in little small tables. You know, you're on the road in a hotel, probably had a roommate.
Yep.
Who'd he sit by on the plane? Okay, sat by this guy. So one player and one staffer led to like six, just from the flight alone, 16 people contact traced.
That's insane.
16. So like between the positive test and the secondary, which wiped out. And here's the deal, Clay. It wasn't just more than a dozen players. It was also, I think of the 11 full-time coaches, like at least seven of them were out for 2 weeks contact tracing. Because because the grad assistant and the one player that I guess his position coach was around. So by the time they missed Tennessee with all those guys out. No one else got it. That number never grew. Those guys were tested that were in quarantine for 2 weeks, seven times.
Ugh.
Not one additional case. So when A&M, by the next weekend, when they played Ole Miss, they didn't have a single player in the program that had COVID, and they couldn't play a football game.
Just because. So what do you know what the quarantine process is like for the A&M guys? So those guys who never test positive, what do they actually have to do? Do they just have to go sit in the, in their dorm room by themselves? They put them in a hotel room. What do they do for that quarantine process?
Well, they typically have, most of the kids live off campus in either houses or apartments. So they're just kind of, I don't know exactly what they, I know that they can, you know, they attend Zoom meetings and stuff,
yeah, right.
and stuff like that, but they can't be in the facilities. And I think they actually can work out, like they can kind of go up there and run and stuff. The ones that don't have it, you know, the
yeah.
ones that are
yeah,
in
yeah.
quarantine.
Because sometimes those guys are in a worse spot, right? Because if you test positive, you can test out by not testing positive anymore. But if you're contact traced, some of those guys can get multiple times contact traced, unfortunately, during the course of a season, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I think they do a good job with the guys that have it. They're good. They're not even in the testing protocol. So if you think about that, like, and that's what teams don't release that information. And I'm sure you're sitting there all across the country, fans of their teams going, man, I wonder if this star player and this star player have had it. Because
right.
if they have, then I don't.
Then
have
you don't
to
have to worry about
them
it.
Ever missing.
Yeah, and you don't end up with a Denver Broncos like situation where suddenly everybody has to not be able to play quarterback, right?
Yeah, and I think they should provide that info. It's not for gambling purposes, but just for the fans' peace of mind. You know, if you look at if you're Florida with Kyle Trask, you know, you're going to the SEC title game. Wouldn't you feel better knowing that you know he had already had it? So nothing can go wrong there. So there is that. That's an interesting part of it. But
especially with the playoff race coming up. Because, right, like at least if
no
you're
question.
Clemson, you're like, well, we know that we don't have to
Trevor's
worry
good.
Anymore about Trevor Lawrence, right? He's going to be there for all the big games that Clemson has the rest of the season.
No doubt about it. I mean, Trevor Lawrence is in the clear. And so it's wild to think that A&M had that few cases and couldn't play. And not only that, but like I said, couldn't practice for 2 weeks. And it you can see where it could mess up the entire season for a team. And the Aggies played LSU. They're probably fortunate they weren't playing a better team because they went out there and they did not look like the same team. But here's the thing. Here's my big complaint of the weekend as far as the A&M narrative went and watching that game, rewatching it on TV. It was a pretty driving rainstorm. They hadn't played in 2 weeks. Kellen Mond tweeted the Monday all the quarantine guys got back and said, I'm back. So one can only assume that he was one of the quarantines.
Yep.
Didn't practice for 2 weeks. And so your quarterback practiced for 3 days leading up to LSU. He looked like a shell of himself. And A&M still led 20-0 before the end of the third quarter. Their last four games by the end of the third quarter, they led LSU 20-0, Arkansas 42-17, South Carolina 34-0, and Mississippi State 28-7. You go back five games and they beat Florida. This team's been playing really good, and they've been throttling SEC opponents. And no one talked about it. And then all of a sudden, in the 1 week where they looked sloppy, and it was not. If I wasn't a fan of either team, I wouldn't have like enjoyed watching that game unless you like seeing great defense, which A&M had. But everybody was just kind of piling on it, and I'm going, wait a second. It's 20-0 through three. LSU's never been within two scores since towards the end of the first quarter. It's not – I didn't understand the hubbub, but it really doesn't matter for the Aggies because if you look at that playoff picture, if they win out, they're going to be sitting right there whether they win these next three games 100-0 or whether they win them each by a point. They're going to be sitting at number five, and they're going to need just a little bit of help. Not much, though.
So, yeah, that's one of the big questions that I have that I think is really kind of fascinating about this entire process. We always have debates about how good someone is and assessing, let's say, the Big Ten versus the SEC or the ACC against the Big 12 or whatever else. How in the world do you assess a team that played six, which may be the case with Ohio State, with a team that might play 12, like might be the case with Notre Dame, or a team that might play 10, like A&M, or 11, like Bama and Florida, and determine how to assess that overall?
I don't think you can assess it. Like, I feel sorry for the committee on trying to figure that one out, because and that's the wild card that really kind of came out of nowhere this past weekend was the Big Ten wild card, not just because of wait, hey, what if Ohio State plays five games or six, But then you've also got the wild card of Northwestern losing. Now, I don't think they'd have any chance against Ohio State. But yeah, if they were to somehow knock off Ohio State, if you're A&M, you're sitting there going, there's a possibility on two different levels now of the Big Ten not getting anybody in. And that would push A&M almost like by default up in there. And then the second part of what you're talking about, yeah, and it's so – how do you compare? Because normally, like you said, you could just sit there and go, okay, this conference did nothing. Of course, if it's the Big 12, they do nothing every preseason, every non-conference schedule, they do nothing. And then by the end of the year, people forget and just keep moving them up as they're beating each other, which is exactly what they're trying to do again with Oklahoma, which just is just mind-blowing right now. I don't get it. That, because they did play non-conference games, and there was the carnage of the Sun Belt. There was Texas Tech being last second to beat Houston Baptist University. I mean, it's just – it is really truly a dumpster fire over there, not just in the conference, but specifically in Austin right now. But I just – I don't think you can really decipher other than to – and I talked with someone on the committee before the season started, and he was telling me it really is going to come down to you hope you have a lot of really strong football minds and people that really understand the game, that when you're watching the games played, you can tell the difference between good football and not good football. Because like never before, you're going to have to lean on that when you're trying to evaluate the strength of conferences and things like that. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. I think the most fascinating thing that could end up happening, and I think it's a legit possibility, you know, if Notre Dame beats Clemson again and A&M wins out, I think the Aggies will be in as long as Bama beats Florida. But what the really fascinating one, and it starts to factor in everything you just asked about, what if Clemson beats Notre Dame by, I don't know, like say 14 points, where you watch that whole game and you're going, Notre Dame would never have beaten these guys. And they could never have beaten them without Trevor, you know, had Trevor not been out. If that's the case, but it's not a blowout, it's not 21-point buzz. It's 10-14, but Clemson total game control. And then you've got a 9-1 A&M team whose only loss was to Bama, who beat Florida, and who is on an 8-game winning streak heading in. That's going to be the most fascinating debate and decision that comes down, is if things shake out like that. And I don't think that's too outlandish a possibility. I actually think that's kind of, if you made me predict how things are going to go, I'd slightly lean towards thinking the Aggies win their last three, and I'd slightly lean towards thinking Clemson by, you know, more than a touchdown, but not in a blowout.
We're talking to Billy Lucci. He's the owner of Tex Aggs. You mentioned the Big 12. There's lots of smoke out there that Tom Herman is in danger of losing his job in Austin. He's asked about it virtually every week in his press conference. Tough loss for them against Iowa State. What are you hearing about that situation for Tom Herman, and who do you think Texas would like? A lot of interest, it seems, in Urban Meyer. The same kind of reports about Urban Meyer that there were about Nick Saban back in the day. $10 million offer. Shelly Meyer's looking around at houses. Everybody's wife always goes to look at houses. What do you think Texas does, and who are you hearing they might be interested in?
I think Texas moves on Tom Herman. And I've had a discussion with people who I respect that don't think that. I just do. Here's the thing, Clay, is this is like, you know, whether it's Michigan, Ohio State, whether it's Alabama, you know, whether it's Auburn with Alabama, it's A&M and Texas and Oklahoma. When Oklahoma's winning and Texas can't beat them, and when you're losing recruits, legacy recruits, who's the Brockermeyer twins, whose father was an All-American tackle, probably the best O-lineman in school history, and they're going to Alabama. You know, Texas kids, they live up in Fort Worth, and they're going to Alabama. And A&M is really getting who they want in Texas in all the head-to-heads with the Longhorns right now. And that's, you know, that's getting more, that stranglehold's getting more by the day with each passing week that A&M wins a game. It is like, it's a real problem for Texas, because if you bring Tom Herman back right now, I just don't see how, if you're an administrator, a decision maker, a big donor, I don't see how you can have any confidence or faith. You know, there's got to be just this giant vote of no confidence if you had asked, can this man and his staff recruit at the level they need to? And as you know, Clay, it's not just this 21 class, which is like they're dead in the water on this one, but it's also the 22 class, which also happens to be the most loaded class I've seen in 25 years of covering this state. So, I mean, if you can fall so far behind that I don't care if they hire Urban Meyer with Nick Saban as his defensive coordinator, it's going to be hard to dig out of that kind of hole. And I think that's what they're scared of more than anything. And you know how success on the other side drives those decisions. A lot of times they're panic driven, right? And,
yeah,
and
yeah.
If A&M wins the next couple weeks and it looks like they have a real look at the playoff, and Oklahoma's righted the ship after those two losses, and you're going to sit there and go tell all your donors and your big money people, hey, we're going to ride this out for another year because, you know, the pandemic and the climate, and, you know, I just don't big business, man, and I just don't think it's gonna fly. I know if you're an A&M fan, trust me, I know, because I read it every single day. I know you're hoping that they don't change coaches, and Aggies were in a very weird spot on Saturday, because I know a lot of buddies of mine that were watching it that were rooting for Texas to win that game, and they felt really weird doing that because you weren't just rooting for them to win. Kansas State's terrible. Kansas is terrible. You were pulling for them to make it, to advance to the Big 12 title game.
Yeah.
And maybe even have a chance to win it with a mild upset over OU, who they went to four overtimes with. And A&M fans didn't even care. Like, oh, fine, let them win the Big 12. That's how just kind of neutered Herman and that program are over there right now.
So,
and I don't say that.
If it's not, yeah, no, I get it. I think it's kind of fascinating. If it's not Urban Meyer, who do you think they would look to?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen a list of about 10 different names, and they get carried away. I've always thought, and it doesn't seem like right now he'd have, to me, if I'm looking, James Franklin, I've always thought would be a good fit for that program.
I think he would have been a great hire, but now they're 1-5, and I don't know how you justify firing Tom Herman in a COVID year for not having a good enough year and go hire, you know, a Penn State coach who went 1-5.
Exactly. I thought they should have hired him when they did hire
Tom Herman,
or Charlie Strong. I forget which one it was, but when he was just.
Late, I think it was Charlie Strong the first time that he was before he went to Penn State.
Yeah, I thought he was going to rip him from your Commodores. Actually,
that's right.
But Texas, a lot of times will think they're too good to do that, and so I've always thought Gary Patterson would be a great fit there, but now he's a little long in the tooth. Again, another one you wonder if they could have hired either of the last two times. I've always thought he would leave for A&M or Texas. I don't know what's out there. You know, Chris Harsin has ties to the program. He's done a nice job at Boise. What's Clemson's offensive coordinator's name? I've seen his name come up.
Yep.
I don't think Texas goes that route. I mean, one of the early names they were throwing around was Kyle Shanahan. The last time they threw around John Harbaugh, like they do this, and I go back to what you just said, and I think that's got to be their big concern, is if you make a change on Tom Herman, who's not terrible. He's not terrible, you know. But if you make a change there and you don't get an Urban Meyer, I mean, then I think you've got a real – they're not going to go hire Hugh Freeze over there. So if you don't get Urban, would you be better off to wait another year and see how Herman does? But see, to me, without Sam Ehlinger, without Joseph Osai, they've already had a couple of opt-outs with guys that are going to get drafted. I just don't see how next year gets any better for them. And it's pretty remarkable, Clay. If you want to compare Kevin Sumlin and Tom Herman, Sumlin was an assistant at A&M under a legend in R.C. Slocum. Herman was an assistant at Texas under a legend in Mack Brown. Sumlin went to OU, won a national title as an offensive assistant under Bob Stoops. Herman, Ohio State, assistant under Urban Meyer, national championship. They both went to U of H. One went back to A&M. One went back to Texas. Strong starts there. You know, Herman in year, I guess, two wins that Sugar Bowl. Sumlin, obviously, we know what happened in year one. And then it just didn't quite work out. And, you know, for the thing to go full circle, I guess it would have to be, you know, they ended up getting Urban, like A&M went and got a national title winner and winning coach, and Jimbo Fisher, and both of them would have been relatively low-hanging fruit in the grand scheme of things, with Urban not coaching and Jimbo, in hindsight now everybody knows, was clearly not getting what he wanted at Florida State and would have left as soon as something, you know, as prestigious as A&M came around, you know, with as good a job opportunity as the Aggies presented.
Billy, appreciate the time, my man. We'll talk to you again down the stretch if the playoff race really gets underway, like I think it could. Appreciate it, my man.
All right, Clay, keep it up, brother.
We are rolling with Petros Papadakis at the Old P on Twitter. Petros and Money Show, AM 570 LA Sports. Petros, I mean, I want to start here because I just think everything's kind of crazy in the world, and it hasn't changed as being crazy. First of all, how good was your Thanksgiving? I'll start there.
Well, I
did you have a traditional Greek Thanksgiving?
No, I had to call a game. I did a game. I did the Utah State hosting New Mexico game, and then the next day we did Stanford-Cal.
Yep, I listened to you on Stanford-Cal game.
Yeah, so we just a lot of work that weekend, like there usually is this time of year for people like me in college football, and I was grateful to do the work, but it was very Spartan as far as the holiday goes. Just me and Alex Faust and our production crew, and a good Mountain West football game, and then a Pac-12 game the next day.
All right, so that transitions really well into the question that I was going to ask you, which is, it appears Stanford basically is going to have to relocate to the state of Washington to get ready for their game. I believe they play against Washington. Cal may also have to relocate. How crazy is this with the way the Pac-12 is shaking out, given all the challenges from the Santa Clara County Health Department or whoever made that decision? And then also with the expectation that another shutdown is coming of an even more significant nature in California, do you fear for USC and UCLA's ability to play and finish their season in California as well? Not to mention, the freaking 49ers are having to move to Phoenix in order to play for the next couple of weeks there.
I think LA football will probably get a waiver because you consider the way the entertainment industry has been able to go forward without any problems. I mean, I walk into three studios a week that are all up and running.
Yeah,
some
good
of them
point.
Require it. Some of them require a test. Some of them don't. So if you look at football at the college level or the pro level as entertainment, I could see them getting a waiver. Now they already. I'm calling the USC game on Sunday night. USC hasn't played on a Sunday since I was playing, but I'm calling the USC game on Sunday night with Alex Faust, and that's USC. Washington State at the Coliseum, and they might move the time again on that, but I've heard that USC is cautiously optimistic that they're going to be able to play. What does this do to the Pac-12 standings, like you mentioned, Clay, or how it shakes out in the conference, like you mentioned? Does it really matter? I mean, it's great to play. They're not going to help themselves by not playing. We have to give the opportunity for the guys that want to move on to the next level next year to let them play. We have to give the – that guy's not honking at me, by the way. We have to give the guys that want to finish their careers that opportunity. Everybody's got to develop that. That's how it works. But is the end game for the Pac-12 to somehow get into the college football playoff? I don't think that's a possibility or a probability this year. Nor do I think it should be. And they've made it too hard on themselves anyway with the late start and the really stringent rules. The problem is, like for USC's situation, the Pac-12 didn't cancel the USC game last week against Colorado. The Pac-12 was the entity that had to make the county aware that USC had more than three positive tests, which constitutes an outbreak, and then they shut you down. So not only is the Pac-12 kind of adherent to their own rules, which seem to be more strict than the other conferences that have been going since September, but you fall under these more draconian counties like Santa Clara and maybe Los Angeles, and so they run into like kind of double issues in that regard. I don't think USC or UCLA is going to have to leave town, but definitely Stanford and Cal are, and they're probably going to be up in the Northwest from what I've heard.
This whole thing is wild, right? And you're talking about the Pac-12 and the fact that they're probably out of the mix for the college football playoff. What do you think about the Big Ten? Because you've done these playoff simulations with me before. We all sit around a table and argue about who we think should be there.
Yeah.
How in the world is the playoff committee going to assess potentially a team like Ohio State if they, as seems somewhat likely, if they may not qualify at all for the Big Ten title game, and if they're only going to end up playing around six games, how do you assess them when you're comparing them with teams that play 11 or 12?
Well, I think you assess them through the past. I mean, I know you're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be a year-by-year thing, but the college football playoff, like the BCS, much like the Heisman, operates in this really weird, regional, very biased fashion. It always has. And I'm not complaining about that. That's just what it is. It's why it's easier to win a Heisman at USC and darn near impossible at a place like Stanford. It's just reality. So, I mean, we've seen Ohio State compete well in this thing every year, right? Just like we see Alabama compete in this thing every year, or Clemson compete in the thing every year. We're used to them being there and competing. So it's not a stretch for anybody because we're used to Big Fox or at ESPN showing Ohio State a lot of love. We can name a bunch of players on their team, their quarterback, their coach, everything about Ohio State. Like Notre Dame, it's a blue blood. So I don't think it's that much of a stretch for Ohio State at all because we all expected them to be there at the end of the season anyway. For a team like USC, no. Even though they're a blue blood, we haven't seen them compete with the Alabamas and the Ohio States and the Clemsons of the world in years. And there's no reason to think they would start now. So I think there's bias of the past that is built in, and that is the path for a team like Ohio State, because there's no way to congruously say, well, you played 11 games and you've been at it since August, but you went to this conference and you've only played seven or whatever, and make a conscious decision. The decision has to be who can compete. Well, we know Ohio State can compete. They do that at this level year in and year out for decades now under Urban Meyer and now Day. So I think, does that answer your question, or is it just more college football subjective gobbledygook? Because that's
I think that's where we're headed is kind of what I'm getting at. It's always in some way a mishmash and a mess because you can kind of find any validation or, you know, there's no set criteria, so we just kind of talk in argument circles. And I think that's going to be arguably even more the case this year, right? Because there's just so much going on. It's like we're not even comparing even remotely similar situations at this point in time because, really, it's hard to quantify a team that only plays six compared to a team that plays 12, right? Like you could have 11-1 Notre Dame being compared to 6-0 Ohio State. How in the world do you assess that? Or 9-1 Texas A&M or 10-1 Alabama, like all these different scenarios that are at play, it's almost incredibly difficult, even more so than normal, to figure out what somebody's worth when they've played half as many games as somebody else.
Well, it's always dumb. And this year, it's just dumber. You know, like just like so many things, the pandemic and how it's all handled in different parts of the world, and how some places you can do this and some places you can't. know, all of that is now applied because we don't have a governing body. All of that, you know, there's not one thing that rules college football. All of that is now trickled down to our world, and something that was already pretty difficult is going to be more difficult. But I don't, I mean, we're going to talk about it a bunch and you're going to ask me about it a bunch, but does anybody really think it's not going to be Notre Dame, Ohio State, Alabama, and Clemson at the end?
I think that's the favorite. I don't think there's any doubt. We're talking to Petros Papadakis, AM 570 LA Sports at the old P on Twitter. How much of a challenge do you think it would be to be a college kid right now playing football? You were a captain at USC. Can you imagine what it would be like to be on a team this year? And what do you think that experience would be like?
Well, the answer is no, and then no again in the pandemic. First of all, with the advent of social media, I would not have survived in a college football program.
You think you would have just said instead or done something dumb as a college kid that would have gotten you in trouble?
I pretty much envisioned my entire team having that issue. But and everybody.
And by the way, the entire campus might also be a way to expand that even further. But yeah, I think definitely people around our age have had those conversations before. Okay, so let's start there. So social media wouldn't have been great for you. Or me, or a lot of other people.
I spend a lot of time talking all week in Zoom calls with coaches, coordinators, players, and head coaches of every team. You know, in the Mountain West, we our Pac-12. That's been my beat this year, and it's fascinating because I mean, you mentioned Santa Clara County. Well, San Jose State, who's having a renaissance year. They just had that game at Boise canceled.
Yep.
They had to go to Humboldt County away from Santa Clara County to have their camp. And, you know, they weren't allowed, and it wasn't even camp because they had to do school all day. New Mexico, as you know, is in Lake Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Quarantined away from their wives and the coaches' wives, the players' dogs and girlfriends for months. You know, they have something like 12 more days in that bubble with zero positive COVID tests because nobody's more isolated than New Mexico. It's amazing. And there's just all these crazy human interest stories all through it. You know, Cal has issues not with the Pac-12, but with the county and getting guys out of quarantine to play. Some people thought Stanford might not have wanted to play or was very reluctant to play this year. So, a lot like all of us in the world right now is they all have really different circumstances and a different perspective on how this should be handled. Most of the people I talk to are incredibly positive. Of course, you know, they're talking to the people doing the media for the game. So, but to a man, everybody's really excited to play and really relishing the opportunity. It does feel like a victory in and of itself when we get a game kicked off.
Yeah.
And it never feels like that before. I mean, it used to be like moving a Mount College football game because of a hurricane or something like that. And we talk about it for weeks, you know, and we didn't just juggle games around like this. And now teams are preparing in short order and traveling in short order. And administrations are working hard to feature the kids. And, you know, we talked about this for months before it happened, Clay. And then we talked about it for months before I got the opportunity to sit and call a game for Fox, which I consider to be a very big privilege I don't take for granted. But, and I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it because we're doing it different. We're calling it off a monitor and there's nobody in the stands and everybody feels a certain kind of way about what should be done. But when I see the joy from the players toward each other and the unadulterated joy to be out there and doing what they do, I feel good about putting the games on TV or being part of the games on TV, a small part. And I think overall that's the most important part of this year. I think we're going to have really exciting, experienced teams for years going forward because of this. Guys that are opting to stay and red shirts and gray shirts and blue shirts and all those things to make room for the scholarships after 2021. I think we're set up if we can have a healthy society for years of great college football, and these young men really learn to overcome a lot of adversity because they faced a lot of adversity. I'd have an incredibly difficult time being disciplined in this situation, as I imagine a lot of people do.
We're talking to Petros Papadakis at the Old P. Every week it's like there's a new story that emerges that there's truly no precedent for. Are you as blown away by the Denver Broncos having to start a random wide receiver from their practice squad after all four of their quarterbacks were not able to play as I am?
Yeah, I just don't understand how some games get moved and some don't, I guess.
Yeah.
And I understand there's probably a list of criteria that Denver didn't meet to have the game canceled. So, and they agreed to those rules, and that's what it was. And hey, let's go. I mean, I've seen football games where every quarterback gets hurt. Some dude's got to take the snaps, and it just doesn't look right, and you don't know what to do offensively, and you're sunk. I've seen that happen before. I've never seen it happen to where, like, that's how you're going out to start the game. You know, that's pretty rough. But, I mean, like you said, I mean, USC hasn't played on a Sunday since I was playing. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different things happening, and frankly, I'm pretty proud of the way that most people adapt to them and adjust and stay positive and try to make it work.
I mean, I do think that's a positive that hasn't gotten enough attention is the SEC, the ACC, and the Big 12 are all going to manage to crown a champion this year, and there's not going to be really anybody that can disagree with it, right? They have managed to find the two best teams. They're going to be able to play a conference championship game. Really, if the Pac-12 and the Big 10 had just done exactly what those two other conferences did, they probably would have been fine. And I think that has to be the most frustrating thing about anybody who's a Pac-12 fan, certainly anybody who's a Pac-12 player, Big 10 player, administrator, coach, all those things, is the pathway actually wasn't that complicated because we've seen what worked with those other conferences.
Well, I think, Clay, you could probably take the word probably out of it.
Yeah.
The Pac-12 would be exactly where SEC, America, Big 12, they would be exactly there, and so would the Big 10. And I think that is a very frustrating thing, but, you know, that's part of what we've talked about for months leading up to these moments, which is the teams that stepped forward and the conferences that stepped forward and took some of the slings and arrows of criticism, whether you believe in what they did was right or not. They're the ones that are able to pull off the most legitimate football season for the reasons that we've discussed over and over again. The ones that didn't and hid behind their local governments or their administrations or just their own lack of confidence to speak up because of where they lived, they're not going to be recognized at the end of the year for a seat at the national table. And they don't have anybody to blame but themselves, and that's okay. With one exception, you know, Ohio State. You know, I think it'll be awfully hard to keep an Ohio State team that hasn't lost any games out of a playoff situation because of what they've done in the past.
We've talked a lot about this Vanderbilt kicker situation. I don't know if you talked about it at all on your show.
No.
You managed to avoid it.
Well, I remember Katie Nida, who played at Colorado with Joel Klatt, believe it or not.
And, yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
and at New Mexico, where she kicked a ball in a Las Vegas Bowl and a PAT, it didn't go through. But Rocky Long, who's a very reputable college football coach, in a bowl game in a Division I game, way back in 2003 or something. Kicked an extra point attempt in the Vegas Bowl.
Yep.
And that, to me, was that moment. I mean, this just, see, they put a different label on it, like the first in the SEC or the first in a Power Five. And to me, this happened.
That's a 20-year-old story for you. It's been like rehashed
And look, and I know Rocky Long, and I respect the hell out of Rocky Long. I don't really know the Katie Nida situation. I wasn't in their locker room. It's hard to know what's acceptable or not acceptable on a team unless you're inside their doors. I do know Derek Mason. I knew him when he was at Stanford, and I liked him a lot back then. That was a long time ago. But to me, it's a 20-year-old story.
Yeah.
That they're resurrecting to have a new generation feel good about. But we've already had this conversation a long time ago. I was surprised that she spoke to the team at halftime. We'll just say that.
Yeah, like if you that to me is the craziest part of the whole story. Like to ask to like, do you ever remember a kicker asking to speak to a team that you were on in football, high school, or college?
No.
And what do you think if you had been at SC as one of the team captains and the kicker had asked to speak to the team at halftime? What do you think your response as a team captain would have been?
That better be Morton Anderson. I mean, this has nothing to do with the young woman and
everything to do with the kicker yelling at the football team.
Yeah, I'm not in their locker room, but if a kicker told our football team that we're not cheering enough on the sideline, I in my time pre-social media would fear for that person, not a woman, just our kicker. Whose name was Adam Abrams.
So if Adam Abrams had stood up at halftime and said, hey, I need to address the team guys and yelled at you because of the way that you were behaving on the sideline, you would have feared for that kicker's safety after the game.
I think, I know you didn't play football, and that's a huge gap between anybody who played at that level and people that didn't. And I don't like football know-it-alls that sit there and talk down to everybody that say, you don't know what it's like, blah, blah, blah. And no one can tell them anything about football because, if you didn't play, you don't know. And, I used to feel that way a little bit, and I'm trying not to be that guy. But there is a certain amount in dues that you pay physically. The dues of being hit, while you're carrying the ball or tackling somebody or just the blocking and tackling element of the game, which is extremely, extremely challenging and takes a great deal of courage. Even if you're a big, strong, scary-looking guy, it is really frightening to do those things. I can tell you from experience. And when somebody has not had those experiences, especially with that team, through the camp, through practices, through the physical sacrifices of playing in the box, it's awful hard to stand up in front of a football team and say anything, if that makes sense.
Makes total sense.